The Guardian.
Hello, welcome to The Guardian Book Club. My name's John Mullen, and I'm here talking to Ian Banks about his novel, The Wasp Factory. And I've got quite an old paperback edition, but I was looking at a newer one, and I see that you've still, or your publisher, Ian, has preserved what I think is quite an unusual practice. I mean, I haven't come across it before, which is that although it rightly says kind things and indeed enthusiastic things,
especially on the
outside,
we've kept the bad ones.
You've replicated with a kind of, with I take it implicit sort of amusement or glee, some really, really stonkingly bad reviews.
Yeah, well, actually,
it is a sick, sick world, says the Irish Times. When the confidence and investment of an astute firm of publishers is justified by a work of unparalleled depravity.
Exactly. they did disappear at one stage. The bad reviews were taken out about 5 years after the book was published. And I had so many people come up to me, usually at science fiction conventions or just at bookshop dues or whatever, and say, where have all the reviews gone? And it's always the same story. I lent mine out and I never got it back. Or it was only it belonged to the flat. You know, my other student pals, I went and got a new one and there were no reviews of it. I got a distinct impression on occasion that they thought the reviews were actually the best bit, you know, and the general tone of the book started to deteriorate once it got to the actual text. However, you know, putting that aside, I then kind of went back to the publisher with this book of impromptu market research and said, I think the reviews have to go back in.
Oh God, my favourite one, the Sunday Express one. A silly, gloatingly sadistic and grisly yarn of a family of Scots lunatics, one of whom tortures small creatures. A bit better written than most horror hokum, but really just the lurid literary equivalent of a video nasty. I mean, putting them in, to be serious, or a bit serious for a moment, does sort of, I mean, it's like, I suppose I remember when I first picked up a copy, and I'd read reviews, and I think I'd read mostly good reviews, enthusiastic ones, but when I picked up the copy and saw those kind of extracts, to me, at the time, I think it signalled that actually the author of this book might be not displeased at having created a mild sort of flutter in the dovecot.
Oh, yeah, I was quite happy for the reviews to go in, certainly, yeah. The thing is, I was complete unknown. I hadn't done anything else in my first, sort of published novel, so it really was a case of any publicity was good publicity. And the fact it was causing a fuss was an entirely good thing. You know, a bit of a fuss can be, it can sell stuff. It makes people, even people that don't like it, will still, in a sense, promote it for you, if you like, So there is a certain Freudian thing about you're using, you're what are supposed to put people off, you're using to pull people in, because a lot of people generally did say they only read it because of the bad reviews. They thought anything that got people in literary London that annoyed had to be somehow good. I think there was a lot of people who later on were reading people like Irvine Welsh, whatever, that were sort of drawn into the book by just by the bad reviews.
But is it also maybe that it has some of the, some of the elements of, I think, what people often associate maybe with kind of, I don't know, genre fiction, with horror fiction, say, that there are one or two scenes, episodes in the novel, which are, carefully choreographed in order to shock. I mean, can I use his word? Maggots in the brain. Can I use those words? I mean, that's...
We should check. Has everyone actually read the book to the end? we're not going to spoil it.
We're allowed to.
Jolly good, right. Just thought we'd better check that. Yeah. I mean, that was actually told to me as a nursing horror story. A friend who was a nurse who worked in Glasgow... Which one was it? It was Glasgow Royal Infirmary, whatever. And they claimed that something very like that had happened. So really, it wasn't entirely my own idea. I just kind of added the details, like the fact that it was Eric that saw this, and Eric had, in a sense, by having too big a head when he was born, had kind of killed his mother, so he'd have this terrible thing, and had always had migraines or headaches or whatever, so it was, which you have to assume is a psychosomatic reaction to that. So when he sees it, it has particular, even greater import for him than it would for, anybody else. I think it would, pretty much, screw anybody up seeing something like that, but yeah, so the rest was just, good description. The best bit was swimming in their own digestive juices. Yes. I got that from a nature programme. God bless David Attenborough.
But I mean, it is a sort of horror convention, isn't it? The person who sees something so terrible, it drives them mad, you know, or it makes them dumb, or, you know, and it's just, I don't know if it has any sort of psychiatric backing, but I mean, in this book, you know, Eric says, doesn't he? He says, the first, almost one of the first things he says is, Frank says to him, "How are you?" "Ha, mad, of course." Yeah, yes. Yeah. And there is a kind of, I mean, were you consciously sort of riding the edge of sort of black comedy when you were doing
that? Oh God, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the book was actually meant to be a lot funnier than most people took it, except most of the people who wrote the bad reviews took it as being. It was meant to be, you know, a barrel of laughs, really, with one or two grisly bits, you know. I've been a good judge of my own fiction, let's be honest, or anybody else's, which is why I don't really do reviews. So yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, it wasn't really aimed specifically in a sense that in a horror market as such, but I was obviously very aware. And I was saying just before we came in, the reason I sent the book initially, say, to Jonathan Cape, was because they published Ian McEwan and Martin Amis at the time. I thought that, you know, The Wasp Factory wasn't that different from anything that they'd done. I think I'd read The Cement Garden by that time. McEwan published that. I read that fairly, yeah. So I thought it kind of, it would fit into their list, I thought. And his name was Ian as well, you know, so... Logical, you'd think, really, wouldn't you? So there was, instead of actually making it, you know, in a sense, directed at the horror market, it was certainly meant to have, you know, sort of, it was meant to be sort of fairly free with its affections in terms of genre or non-genre, whatever.
Does it mean, I mean, do you think it means, as some of the maybe more thoughtful and more complimentary reviewers thought, that in a way, you know, you were discovering or showing that in what is often, especially nowadays, thought of as a sort of completely unserious genre, horror. But there's a kind of, that there's stuff in there which is actually kind of quite a lot of literary interest, although usually perhaps dealt with in quite sort of trivial ways.
Well, I don't think I had that sort of, you know, quite that didactic sort of purpose in mind. I mean, if you'd put it to me at the time, I'd probably said, yeah, sure, you know, that's a perfectly good way of expressing it. But it wasn't, I mean, I was just trying to write an interesting story in a sense, and one that would engage people, and one that would, it was, and I was at the time, I was very concerned that I wasn't going to get published at all. I'd been writing, I've been trying to write novels since I was about 14, and I'd started writing, you know, well, something that looked the same as a novel. I had the same number of words as a novel when I was 16. By this stage, I was like, you know, 25 or something, and I thought, and of course, when you're 25, 30 seems like, you know, incredibly old. You know, what is now at the age of, say, a number at the top of my head, say, 54. You know, 54 doesn't seem terribly old at all, honest, you know. So I was very concerned that I was deliberately writing something that was quite, you know, deliberately, in a sense, designed to be commercial. And I kind of knew at the time it was probably going to be the most commercial thing I was ever going to write. And so I was trying to make it as saleable as possible. I was thinking ahead, I was trying to think, would a publisher actually want to publish it? Can it be wrong, you know, six times out of seven?
He does construct an extraordinary kind of, a kind of primitive religion of sort of death, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, early on, I remember that you were talking about children's games. I mean, one of the things that seemed fantastic about it and sort of grotesquely believable was the way that sort of those kind of children's games involving destruction and manipulated destruction, you know, you build a town only in order to flood it and destroy it. You get put lots of soldiers out only in order to kind of, you know, aerosol them with a flamethrower and destroy them all. Which I recognise all that. I mean, so why not some animals, you know, after that? And it seems like a logical kind of progression.
Yeah, the kind of escalation there. So, yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, certainly the book was also meant to be a kind of a dig at religion as well. You know, sort of, I don't think I was quite at the stage of describing myself as an evangelical atheist then. You know, that came later. But it also was meant to be about, just, you know, inhumanity and humankind, I suppose, in a way, and trying to look at. I'd always been struck by, you know, this thing, terrible thing that we have about revenge, you know, and the one thing that always struck me was, when the Nazis, one of their high-ranking people was killed near a village or whatever, or a town, they go and just kill everyone in the town, you know, and somehow this, I think this continues to this day, in a way. You know, American Marines have done not dissimilar things. I mean, was it Haditha, wasn't that the kind of similar deal? That you're this, especially when you're part of a group, you know, this terrible thing about wanting revenge because one of your buddies has been killed or whatever, and you just go and kill anyone because they're nearby or whatever, and we just have this awful tribalism about us. You know, so Frank's kind of meant to, in a sense, encapsulate that. I mean, it's done, you know, in a sort of Grand Guignol sort of almost comical fashion, because the entities that Frank takes severe umbrage at are rabbits, you know, and flamethrowers of rabbits, whatever.
But it has got one of the most frightening rabbits in world fiction.
I know, yes. I think only
attacked by a very, very aggressive.
Only the killer rabbit in Monty Python, the Holy Grail, I think, really beats that one, yes, yeah. I remember writing that and thinking, I'm going to get away with this, you know, some homicidal mad killer rabbit, you know. So.
But then.
Sorry, yeah.
But so, I mean, Frank's kind of avenging himself partly on, well, he makes all these comments, doesn't he, which I didn't notice at all when I first read it, but then they're like sort of little snap triggers when you read it the second time about women. And yes, indeed, he even, of course, and this, Henry Fielding does this, he does this, really clever. You read it, and in the second chapter, I think it's the second chapter, when he goes to the toilet. And I remember at the time thinking, when I first read, what's the point of that one? I don't want to go into the toilet with this guy. Thank you very much. And he says, oh, I have to sit down as if I was a woman. So you actually kind of give it away. You give it
kinda,
away.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, a few people do guess. You know, I mean, how many people here guess before you got to the end of the book?
Oh,
that's
just
about
the Mensa members. They're not.
That's about, you know, about the right normal proportion. Right. Some people do, I think. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. A lot of it is about symbols. I mean, Frank, you know, obviously says it, and I think there's one bit where the line goes, "My main enemies are women in the sea."
Or something.
Yeah. And there's a lot of sort of symbolic value there. You know, that these things that matter so much to Frank. They're embodiments of something of a conflict, if you like, within Frank as a person. You know, that's getting a bit Freudian, so we'll step swiftly away from that.
What about his dad? I wanted to ask about his father and his kind of, I suppose, first of all, the logic of his motivation, because it seemed, maybe I'm wrong, but it seemed that the last time I read it, as well as the first time I read it, that it was quite important that he wasn't just a kind of, you know, evil, nasty person, that he's got his own, but he's got his own reasons. I just wondered what those reasons are for his...
I can't bloody remember.
Is it kind of revenge against, you know, is it treated badly by women?
It's about the mother, yes, yeah. It's about Agnes. It's just about that, really. I mean, it's about not wanting to have a woman on the island, and, you know, one way of doing that is to tell the one that is there that she's not. There's one of the little sort of hidden things in the book. One of the great sort of perks of being a writer is you get to sort of hide things and reveal them later on. Like, for example, in Complicity, there is the happy ending to The Bridge. Ha! So The Bridge has got a happy ending, it's just not at the end or in the novel itself. Anyway, in The Wasp Factory, I was thinking, what is there anything I haven't sort of talked about very much? And the way that, I don't think this comes out, I haven't read it for a while myself, but at the end, when Frank sort of finds the chemical sort of lab thing, basically Angus is making acid. He makes little sort of sheets of acid, LSD, and that's how he makes his money. And when he goes to Inverness every...
God, I didn't get that. I've read it three or four times. I didn't...
Well, you're not meant to get it. You know, I'm meant to go, ha-ha, you see? But there's no family fortune. Well, there is, you know.
Because in your novels, there is a family fortune.
Yeah, well, isn't really in this one. But that's how he makes any money at all. Because he's a doctor, you know. So.
Because he says, Frank says in, I think, the first chapter, he says... I think he might have invented something once, and he might still be getting some money from it.
Yeah,
no.
Well, you mentioned that was the first piece, was it, or the second? Yeah.
I think it's the first piece.
Because I'd forgotten I'd written that bit about he might have invented something.
So that's just a false... That's
absolutely. We call it a red herring in the trade, don't you know?
Yeah. Right.
But yeah, that's what's... Frank actually finds little bits of paper. I can't remember if there's a symbol on them, but I mean, the old days, you know, when acid really was acid, not like the rubbish you get nowadays, you know, it's Superman
symbols.
Of course,
he's an old drug head.
Exactly,
isn't
he's an old hippie, basically.
Yeah.
Ha ha ha, there you go. Yeah. That's all, I've got nothing else. So I'm out now, you know. Yeah.
And he's also a kind of alcoholic or an ex-alcoholic?
He's definitely had recreational substance abuse problems, shall we say. Yes, yeah. I can't remember if I actually made him an ex-alcoholic. Well, I mean, he's definitely, I think he's, because he gets very drunk at the end. That great slug conversation. I'm in a library and stuff. I can't actually remember if I made him like a reformed alcoholic.
Because he always seems to be quite anxious about his, you know, he's always needling his son about whether he's been drinking or if he's been drinking too much, in the way that somebody who perhaps always wanted to drink themselves.
Thinking back, that was more about really not wanting Frank to get drunk in case Frank actually had a sexual encounter. You know, someone said, just a minute, I recognise one of these. So I think it was more about that rather than from a sort of plot point of view, from Frank's point of view, rather than from the dad's point of view.
So when he goes off, when he's saying, oh, I'm going off and... the son says, oh, he might be going to Inverness or he might just be going into town, and he puts on these extraordinary sort of brown tweeds. That's his drug peddling.
He's off to sell drugs in Inverness, the sin city of the Highlands.
And what about his sort of obsession with measurement, and he sticks labels on everything in the house with their dimensions?
That's kind of gratuitous, frankly. Yeah. I just wanted something really eccentric, and I remember... the area where the book is set is north Inverness, and it's very near a place that I was working from the time I kind of got inspired by that bit of landscape. I was living in a wee place rejoicing the name of Port Mahomock, and working at the Nig Bay oil sort of platform yard. And I was working in, at the time it was the only profit-making division of British Steel. It was called Unit Inspection. And what they did was when they were making these gigantic legs of production platforms in the North Sea, you had to sort of, once you sort of rolled them together in sort of huge machines and sort of welded them, you know, enormous good big things, you had to make sure the welds weren't going to fall apart and, you know, kill hundreds of workers or whatever. And so I was part of the team that was doing the non-destructive testing. The non-destructive bit really rankled. But you can't do it. So we use like radiography and ultrasonics and all that sort of stuff. So you had lots and lots of these enormous great pipes and bits of metal and all of it all lying around, and they all had, you had this sort of stuff. It's a bit like, you know, they still make Primula cheese that used to squeeze out of a tube, like a giant sort of, you know, mistake it in the dark for toothpaste, you know, that sort of stuff. Well, you had these things, and there were markers for marking the steel plates, and so these things were always covered in lots of little things, and they were usually just saying, telling you what it was and what size it was and where it was going to go in the finished production platform. And then when they'd done the testing, they would say there was a slag inclusion here, or there's a cavity down, you know, 3 centimetres down and 2 in or whatever here. So all these great big industrial thing covered in little tiny little bits of white writing that you sort of squeezed out from there. I think that was where the thing about a house being sort of plastered with things telling you exactly what the diagonal length of the door was, whatever. And it kind of came from that. Just thinking about these things that were all sort of, they had their measurements on them, you know, it just seemed. I was taken by the idea and I tried to put it into. You know,
well, he has got that. I mean, it kind of fits, I guess, with the father's, you know, as an academic with children, I recognise all too well that kind of thing which I think normal parents probably don't do, of only asking questions you already know the answer to, you know, which is what parents and academics do all the time.
Yeah.
And if, you know, and he obviously is a kind of, because partly the novel is about, you know, somebody who sort of, as Frank says early, quite early on, oh, I know lots, I'm educated, and there's a library, and he knows tons, but he hasn't been to school or anything like that. And it sort of seems to fit, I guess, with that father's habit of kind of, you know, asking, you know, he knows lots of stuff. Mm. He apparently once worked at a university himself, except he also is kind of quite keen on sort of bogus knowledge and fake bits of information.
Mostly the excuse for bad jokes, really. Yes. You know, those bits. Yeah, the Irish peat treading the Guinness, Irish peasants treading the peat to make Guinness, and Vitreous being a town in China. They don't see Vitreous China much these days, you know. Flatio being a character in Hamlet, stuff like that. Yeah.
Pathos, one of the three.
Pathos, one of the three musketeers, again, those were just excuses. A lot of times when I was writing the book, I thought, it's flagging, it's not funny enough, or nothing's happening. So I'd either throw in a bunch of little jokes like that, or another phone call from Eric, which always kind of lifted the lunacy factor significantly, you know. And for a short book, you know, There's a lot of times when I felt it was flagging. I just needed to, you know, it was too much expedition or nothing exciting has happened, you know. And I think it's a legacy of writing stories in my head when I was a kid that were based on sort of adventure series like The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and stuff like that, or Danger Man, or The Prisoner later on. And you also had to have an action scene, and some, you know, a lot of popular fiction at the time, Harold Robbins, I'd never actually read any, but I'd heard he always had a sex scene every like 40 pages or something like that, or whatever, you know. I remember thinking you have to keep people's interest up, so again I was constructing the book and that sort of populist,
but I think it reminds me of Robinson Crusoe in certain ways, not just because of, you know, being on an island and all that stuff, which is kind of half paradise but half nightmare, but also actually because it seems proof that if a narrator is fascinated enough themselves, if you can believe they're fascinated enough themselves about their own bizarre business that they spend, you know, because, I mean, with Robinson Crusoe, it's all, and then I did this, and then I placed it there, and I constructed, you know, and I find all that totally gripping. Mm. And I felt exactly the same about Frank's weird descriptions of what he was doing with the sacrifice poles or the wasps, or the candles, or the altars, or, you know, his strange kind of destructive games with animals.
I guess because there's a bizarre and very twisted, but there is an internal logic there. Yes. And the sacrifice poles are like CCTV cameras, you know. And the wasp factory itself, so obviously it's a divination.
Well, yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. Where, I mean, that's a kind of... why is that so important, do you think, to the novel and to his... obviously... You know, it's provokingly important because the first thing you do when you pick up the thing, the wasp factory.
What the hell is that?
Those two words have never wasp and factory have never gone together before in the history of English. So how, you know, what, and it's a while before we find out, you know, we get the factory told me.
Oh yeah,
that's
first
paragraph. First, yeah. I mean, why is that sort of that's a practice of divination?
Well, it kind of became,
which Crusoe does as well, actually. He does it.
It kind of became emblematic. I mean, the book wasn't called that initially. I think it was always going to be a chapter title, because I just liked the idea of the chapter title. But I think there's about two or three of the chapter titles that were kind of contenders for being the title of the novel as a whole. And the Wasp Factory just kind of, you know, evolved to be the top of the... It threw the other ones out the nest, kind of. You know, it became the obvious one, in a sense. And I think it was, again, because of the religious thing, apart from anything else. And it was, I always knew it was going to be a macabre kind of book. And then Frank would be doing horrible things to, you know, fellow creatures or whatever. So anything that involved, you know, 12 different types of death just seemed like a natural. And I think also it's because of that religious sort of aspect, because we are, even if you're an atheist, you kind of understand religion. Most of them have been brought up in, you know, quite close proximity to it, even if I haven't actually been indoctrinated into it or whatever. So we all kind of understand it. And there is a religious sort of drive in humankind. I think almost any atheist would admit that. It's there. It's largely, you know, a perversion of the urge to find out what's going on. You know, obviously the correct way to do that is through science, the scientific method, you know. But people come up with, you know, wonderful ideas about how things are actually working. You know, they're wrong, technically, but it's interesting. And I think because of that, anything that is identifiably of a religious nature and kind of has the... It's got to have some of the same components as well of you know, real religions. So for the iPod people, I've just done that rather annoying sort of thing with the fingers, you know, doing inverted commas. Yeah. I did it again when I was explaining it. So I apologize. Anyway, Ian Bax is so-called writer. So it has to sort of look and feel like a proper religion. As an atheist, you know, to me, Frank's religion makes just as much sense as Catholicism, you know, or anything else, really. And slightly more than some of the more wacky ones. My partner is a lapsed Jew, and she has great fun with, you know, the reasons why, you know, Judaism still has, you know, rules about not eating shellfish and stuff like that, or cloven birds, or something, I don't know what the hell it is, you know. None of the rules that Frank has are really any more ludicrous than some of the rules.
No,
that,
well, I mean,
the major established religions are, put it that way.
I guess the thing in Frank's weird sort of belief system and his strange rituals and catechisms, he calls them,
ah, yeah,
that is that is unlike some religions, but very reminiscent of some of those books I've mentioned, like Robinson Crusoe and the Rousseau manual for how to educate your kids by letting them sort of run wild in nature. Yeah. The thing that's particular is that, I mean, lots of religions have stuff like, most religions have stuff like religious books and priests who tell you what they mean and Frank, like old Crusoe on his island, he's just liberated to kind of look at nature and work it out from there. Mm. And instead of working out like a kind of good 18th century optimistic person, oh, I'll look at nature, it's all really ordered. There must be a God, and he must be a kind kind of God, and he's looking after me, and he's saved me from the shipwreck. And he looks at it and he sort of thinks, death. Hmm. Violence.
Well, I seem to recall there's an exchange in the book between Frank and Eric about, Eric says he couldn't believe that God would let that happen, and Frank says something like the God that he believed in would. You know, so he believes in that, you know. I think there's an excuse for believing in God, but only to blame rather than worship, really, you know. So, but that's being pessimistic, frankly. So I think Frank's kind of got that sort of idea, you know, that if there's a God, or, I mean, it's animist, really, you know. And
yes,
I think that's the only time when the idea of God, that Frank ever uses the concept of God in the whole novel, I think. I wouldn't swear to it. It's a long time since I read it. I think that's the only time that God's actually mentioned. The rest of the time it's animism. It's all about, you know, the souls of animals or any overall creator, I think.
And what about the end of the novel? I mean, presumably the sort of éclaircissement. Mm. I've never used that word before at the book club.
It's about time.
Daring to do it, but I've now done it. At the end, yeah, the sort of the revelation. I mean, you had that packed up and ready from the word go.
Well, I mean, from the word go, I've started to write The Blighter, yeah, but not from the whole sort of planning stage. No, that was, I mean, the book was basically ready to go for about 3 or 4 weeks before I actually started writing it. And then I thought, it can actually be a girl all the time. And I thought, does that make sense? Can I make that work? I'd had to sort of go back through this, all the plans that I'd made up. Because I think there's a bit that's going to appear on Saturday. I try to explain about, you know, my way of writing novels is I have to know what's going to happen. Otherwise, I just get lost. And there was one novel I wrote years ago, that Long Before the Wasp Factory. It just went on and on and on and on and on, apparently forever. And it ended up about 400,000 words. I kept sort of trying to... I started out with 6 sets of major characters, which is not a good idea. And it was... anyway, it went on forever. I kept on trying to, you know, wrest it to the ground and tie it off and stuff. And it took me, you know, about 4 different plans before I finally got that to work. So that was kind of my, you know, shocking experience. I was so traumatised by this event that I always wanted to plan my books after that. Mm-hmm. So The Wasp Factory was ready to go. And kind of, I could have ready to sort of press the button on it at any point, and I said, so right, I can write this. When I thought of the surprise ending, and went back and made sure it all still made sense, and then put one or two little clues in, like the clue about, you know, sitting down, and I think there's a bit where Frank sort of has a pee in a garage forecourt as well, isn't there?
Yeah.
I think it mentions the rough concrete or something.
Yes.
There's a mention of, because I was looking for literary clues as well. I think Myra Breckinridge is mentioned
Indeed.
And there's another one.
His dad gives, dad gives him.
There's another kind of slight hint about male, female, about cross-gender, you know, gender uncertainty, whatever, in there. I can't remember what the hell it is, but Myra Breckinridge, I remember thinking, oh, there's a little clue here. So it was always there from, you know, when I wrote that first, you know, the first paragraph, it was already in my head, that's what the ending would be. But for a couple of months, before, you know, I was still writing the novel, it was in that sense a lot more conventional. I can't remember what the hell. I think at that point the house was going to blow up, because, you know, the thing that doesn't happen, the dog that doesn't bark,
yes,
at the end, is that the cordite in the cellar does not blow the whole,
yes,
island to smithereens. So, but instead you're hit with, you know, an emotional explosion.
So does it, I mean, at the ending, let me ask you the question. You're not supposed to ask about the ending, but as I've got the authority of Jane Austen, because she didn't mind being asked about this question about the ending.
It's good enough for now, Jane. It's good enough for me.
Her friends and family used to ask her what happened after the novel ended. And instead of saying, you know, as kind of some sort of cool sort of modernist would say, the ending is the ending. She would say, oh, well, yes, well, Jane Fairfax only lived another 6 years, and I'm afraid she died, and stuff like that. So, I mean, but the ending, you know, there are endings where there's an unimaginable beyond, and then there are endings, you know, like Pride and Prejudice, where, of course, that's where it ends, but it's an ending which does rely on you believing there is a beyond, you know, and they're not going to get divorced, and they are going to get on quite well, and all that sort of stuff. I sort of wondered about the ending and the sort of the non-blowing up of the house, and it's sort of the last sentence, isn't it, about Eric...
bombs frying.
Oh, yes.
I think the last word's actually, isn't it?
No, the last word is he's got a sister.
Sister, that's
poor
right.
Poor Eric came home to see his brother, only to find Zap, pow, damned to birth, bombs got wasp right. He's got a sister.
It was important that it was, because I was a new man, still am actually. Bit of a feminist, you know. It was important, when I thought about it, but I had my, you know, surprise ending. I thought, the word sister has to be the last word. Yeah, I remember that now. He says, honest, it's true.
Well, look, I think it's time, probably past time, when I should give readers who are perhaps better at picking up those clues that I missed their chance. Yes, the lady. The lady in the middle and then the gentleman at the back.
I'm Sally.
Hi.
I'm only 17 and The Wasp Factory is the first kind of gothic-y horror novel that I ever read. And I got suggested to read it and I didn't find it scary, really, the killings and everything. I found them really clever. Until we got to the point where Eric sort of went mad, which I thought was really graphic. And I wondered, is there any reason why, when Frank sort of went mad with his killings, why that wasn't as graphic, but when Eric, his brother, went mad, it was really, really kind of... It scared me, it freaked me out when I read it.
Do you mean the bit where the bit with the brain? Uh-huh,
yeah. Well, I mean, the obvious answer to it is that because I had a sort of template for that. I say that had been told to me as a true story, so that kind of gave an extra sort of frisson, as it were. Whereas, you know, Frank's stuff I had to make up all by myself, you know, and arguably failed. I never really came up with saying packed, as it were, as instantly traumatic as what happened to Eric. You know, there's a good chapter title. You know. Frank is kind of, I think the idea was a way that something actually, or sort of a bad thing had to happen to Eric, and that sort of kind of drove him bonkers, whereas Frank, the bonkersness goes all the way through, and it's all about having been lied to and just being brought up wrongly, you know, being brought up as the wrong gender, basically, and swallowing all this nonsense that's, you know, that Angus has told him, her, you know. So, there's no actual point where Frank goes mad. Frank is kind of raised to be mad, in a sense, but to be twisted, if you like. Maybe that's a better way of describing it.
But isn't it also maybe because Frank's telling the story? And that's why.
Well, yeah.
When he tells stories about murdering people, I mean, it's not that horrific at all, is it? It's quite funny to some extent. And, and he says about killing this 4 or 5-year-old, Well, I went and did it quickly because I quite liked him. Yeah. And
it's just a stage I was going
Whereas Eric, it's happened to somebody else. And so, and that's much more unpleasant.
I don't want to give myself too big an excuse here because basically Frank is meant to be a quite reliable narrator.
Yes.
The only bit that's not obvious nonsense is the bit where Frank thinks that he's getting through to Eric's telepathy nonsense via the candle inside the skull of old Saul, and all that happens is she burns her hand, that's all, and there's no sort of weird George Lucas Spielberg like sort of freaky nonsense going on at all, intellectual blowback from the person you're trying to contact, rubbish. But otherwise Frank is actually meant to be a reliable narrator. I kind of knew about unreliable narrators and so on at the time, but Frank is really meant to be telling you the truth. And one of the most important bits for Frank's reliability, in a sense, is the bit where he sees the lights of what he works out their drilling rigs out to sea. And it's a sort of temperature inversion. He sees these weird lights out over the sea. He says, a less imaginative, a less clever person would assume they were UFOs. Frank is much more grounded, and he knows how things work. And yet, it's just drilling rigs, just the flares from drilling rigs, whatever. And that is kind of meant to give you an idea that Frank is reliable. And having said that, obviously putting a good gloss in it, about the killings and so on. Whereas, yeah, Eric gets described by a not entirely sympathetic person, put it that way.
Unlike the woman over there, I've only ever read one of your novels. The rest of them don't have shit reviews.
sincere about that, sir. Don't you worry.
A comment. For the whole interview, you've referred to Frank just simply as Frank, while you've referred to him as he.
Well, this is,
he,
Frank, he, Frank. It doesn't matter because...
Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah, I know, but it's just been...
I've spent 24 years trying not to spoil anything for people, so I usually always do refer to Frank as Frank, but I'm okay, I can come out now. Yes, I can say Frank is a he or a her or whatever.
But it wasn't until he talked about the sequel that you called Frank right. her. Yeah, so it was very it was interesting to see. You've spoken about, obviously, the references about Lord of the Flies and as well. So for me, it's about instinct, but then there's that corruption of instinct as well, which is the father and the corruption of that instinct as well. Where do you draw the line? What do you see as being Frank's instinct, and what actions are his corruption or her corruption of instinct?
Ooh, that's a tricky one. God, the good questions are always difficult, aren't they? Bloody hell. Well, in a sense, that's not really for me to say. I mean, it really is for the reader to determine themselves, you know. The book, as I said earlier, was trying to say something about the nature and nurture debate. I think I probably came down slightly too much on the nurture side. I think, you know, there obviously are. I think there's probably slightly more intrinsic differences between male and female children of that age or the age of... we hear about Frank from, you know, childhood onwards, to adolescence, whatever, than, you know, I was kind of assuming at the time, put it that way. The fashion of the time was to kind of pin it all on nurture rather than nature. So that sense, if the book has that kind of didactic, not such purpose, but result, then I think it's probably, it errs slightly too far towards the nurture side of the argument. Like nature probably has a... So it's kind of a bit, you know, skewed in that sense. But I can't really say, you know. I just write a damn thing. I don't really decide what it means, for God's sake.
Well, my follow-up then was how much of the nature was drawn from what you felt would be your own instinct in those situations?
Oh, I suppose all of it, in a sense. I mean, you know, there is an argument that every character in a novel reflects the author in some way, you know, even the horrible ones or whatever. And I said I'd use a lot of stuff that happened, I'd done whatever as a kid, but grossly exaggerated. I used to make bombs and dams and play with things, you know, on beaches. And I used to go to the town dump in Gourock, not anywhere in the north, but on the Costa del Clyde. So a lot of stuff that I'd kind of done, but in a perfectly, you know, legit and reasonable and not killing anyone at all, honest, you know, a few flies, a few hundred flies, actually. Anyway, you know, I exaggerated, you know, for a comic and dramatic effect for Frank. You know, so there was that kind of grounding. And again, that's maybe what John was talking about the feeling that if you're describing it well, the character's in that place, then it will make sense. You will find it gripping when Frank's talking about absolutely arcane nonsense about, you know, how soldiers melt when you turn a flamethrower made from an aerosol or a can or something on them. You know, so I'd kind of done that stuff, but without actually harming anyone, you know, least of all me, happily. So Frank does it as much more, you know, devastating and deliberately murderous effect. But yeah, I'd kind of done all that stuff. So, in terms of me. The thing is, I mean, I had a great childhood and I had the best possible start you can get as a kid. I was loved. My mum and dad, you know, loved me, and I was I wasn't absolutely spoiled. They couldn't afford to spoil me for a start, but I kind of, as an only child, you know, I kind of got everything that was going. And if I found a Lego set late November, I knew that come Christmas, that Lego set would be mine. Oh, yes, it wasn't going to be any siblings. I say fine, you know. Takes a bit of doing when you're turning the whole house upside down and your mum and dad happen to be having the back stunned or something or doing the decorating, so you end up in the loft, you know, desperately trying to find where they've hidden the loot, you know. From that point of view, I'm profoundly unlike Frank in that way, you know, but I use things that were common in a sense, things that I'd experienced or that I'd done, but it's just, after that, it's just exaggeration. And I think having written science fiction, and I kind of thought of myself as a science fiction writer before I came to this book, that kind of helped. You get used to a lot of exaggeration. Well, we call it extrapolation in science fiction, but it's basically exaggeration, let's be honest. But no, I had
Frank's childhood is sort of idyllic in a sort of way,
in a way,
isn't it?
You know, half the three murders, yes.
And, you know, well, I know, but I mean the place, the setting.
Oh, it is, yeah, absolutely. It's meant to be fun.
You know, and Rousseau did have this thing that if you put kids in a beautiful place, they will be better people. It will make them into better people. Mm. So, you know, it is a kind of...
Well, it's good for Frank, you know. For anybody else around him, no. Well, I do see the point, but it's described with some glee, and that was quite deliberate as well. You know, Frank's quite unapologetic about it. You know, the most you ever get is that line about just a stage I was going through. There's not really any great amount of regret, even in that bit at the end. I was saying to Julian about the bit where James Hale asked me to put in about Frank giving a little bit of reasoning, as it were. You know, show you're working behind your emotional trauma as well. Yeah, I'm still not sure it really works in the sense as a, you know, it's kind of like it's a plea of mitigation, I suppose. You yes. know, it's what a clever defence lawyer would come out with, you know, hoping to reduce the sentence a bit. That's all.
I read The Wasp Factory about a week ago because I was recommended it by two of my friends and my teacher. We're studying Gothic for English literature, so I thought I'd give it a go because I heard it was really twisted and weird, and that's my sort of thing. One of the key things about the novel is that how different it was from anything else I've read, because I'd never read Lord of the Flies or anything like that. And I just wondered, before you sat down to write it, did you actually think, I really want to make a twisted novel that people are going to look at? And, you know, there are parts in the novel where you have to do a double take to realise what's actually happened. And you think, did that really happen?
Not really, but I didn't... Not a twisted novel. To me, it was always going to be a sort of comic, you know, a black comedy, you know, and the comedy part was always meant to be quite a strong component of it. It was meant to be, you know, shocking, interesting, and as I was saying, like, I'd really had me... My sort of templates, you know, my influences were people like Martin Amis and Ian McEwan, and I thought, like, I could do stuff like that that's kind of disturbing, it's got young people in it, blah, you know. But it was meant to be sort of funnier in a way. And it actually wasn't really meant to, apart from maybe the maggot scene, it wasn't really meant to be shocking either. That's why I was slightly bemused when I discovered, like, the sort of vehemence of the reaction to it. I should have kind of known. You know,
What about the word your reader used, which has been used quite a few times, although not by you, I think, this evening, Gothic. I mean, is that...
That's
definitely how... I think I have... It was a long time ago, but I remember reading an anthology of critical writings, very kind of kosher anthology edited by a couple of very good people, and it was called something like Modern Gothic. And it had kind of, you know, stuff about Tim Burton films, and you can imagine about you in it. Do you think Gothic's a good word to use?
I suppose it is. I mean, I'm not really up in Gothic. Well, you know, there we are. Yeah. Yes and no. If that's what people want to attach to it, that's fine. It was not deliberately Gothic, you know, and I'm still a bit hazy about what Gothic really sort of means. Was it just a castle of Otranto or something? And I kind of knew the effect.
Well, a kind of lonely building with a locked room, and, you know, yes.
Oh, yeah, that's kind of where I was using those sort of components. I'm not sure I'm attached to, in my strange little brain at the time, it never really, the word Gothic never got flagged up as being an irrelevance. So I think looking back at it, I suppose obviously it has. You know, it's got Gothic influences as well, but I didn't sort of determine to be so at the time, you know. So, but it actually wasn't really meant to be that shocking. Years later, I thought, I'll show you shocking. So I wrote a book called Complicity, but just meant to be deliberately shocking. This is where I came up with my only real, and frankly, not very cogent or useful contribution to the world of English letters in terms of criticism, which is the antibody theory of criticism, which is that at the time, the body of English letters, you know, back in 1984 or whatever, existed, and then along came the Wasp Factory, and there was this sort of virulent new disease introduced, and it caused this horrible reaction, and those temperatures and things and all the stuff that happens to a body when a new disease comes in. But it wasn't really that shocking, but it appeared to be. And then when I wrote Complicity, which was meant to be shocking, it was too late because the antibodies from the Wasp Factory were already in the body of English letters, so no one found it that shocking. I thought, bugger. So that's the antibody theory of literary criticism. I for a wee while I was getting slightly annoyed people calling it, you know, I was deliberately being shocking. It's not that shocking, you know. I think in retrospect I was probably just wrong, you know, but it is quite shocking really, you know. But at the time it was just that, you know, a lot of the time when you're writing, when I'm writing stuff like this, it's a kind of technical problem. You think about, how do I best describe this quite possibly a very horrible thing. If it's a funny thing, a funny scene, you're trying to make it as funny as possible. If it's a horrible scene, you're trying to make it as horrible as possible. And you kind of you're a step away from the moral implications of that and how it's going to affect, especially a kind of sensitive reader. You know, it never occurs to me. You know, you're on your own, tough. You know, just a bit irresponsible in some ways. But hey, that's what it's being a writer these days. So I think that there's that sort of dislocation between intended effect and actual effect in a way, you know. Comment.
Well, it's been recommended in schools now.
I know, shocking. So, I think that should be allowed.
The gentleman here with the glasses thing.
You're a writer who writes two different kinds of books, and you kind of write your regular novels and your sci-fi novels.
And the skiffy stuff, yes.
I was wanting to ask you about the inclusion of your books in the film Hot Fuzz.
Oh, yes, Bill Bailey character.
The Bill Bailey character in the film Hot Fuzz. You see him as two characters, one who was reading an Ian Banks book and one who's reading an Ian M. Banks book. Yeah. Do you think that's an accurate portrayal of your two kinds of readers?
Absolutely. Hell yeah, yeah. I think the guy with the beard is an Ian M. Banks fan. Makes perfect sense to me.
Because one's really nice and one's really grumpy. So yeah. I wondered if that was...
I can't remember which way around it was. Can you remember?
The Ian Banks was a grumpy one and Ian Banks was a nice
one. Science fiction fans are generally a very sunny disposition, yeah. You know. To everybody else, it's a bit weird, frankly. You know, so I forgot. No, I think chuffed would be the word I would use to describe my reaction. I'd heard from a couple of people before I saw the film that the books are in there. So I don't know if they have Simon Pegg or Bill Bailey, so happens to be a fan, or you know, I had no idea. But I consider me flattered either way. You know.
With the lady in the middle, and there's another. Sorry, I give them a. Is that okay? And then you can pass, after you've asked yours, somebody two places down again.
Do you think the shock factor is about having Frank as the narrator? Because you don't actually have anybody else commenting on Frank's actions. The dad isn't any kind of moral authority, is he? I can't think of any other character who grounded in any sort of way. So,
well, it's entirely sort of first person narrative.
Yeah, and it's kind of his little comments.
I think it makes it less shocking, though. I think if you're describing this, if you had a standard omniscient narrator or whatever, or someone else describing what Frank does, and I think this is the kind of just behaviourist list of things that are done would be more shocking. The fact that Frank does have this slightly sort of breezy cheerfulness about him, you know, that is kind of infectious, and we think, oh, he's just killed another child, but quite ingeniously. What am I thinking of? He's murdered a child. I think because of his use of the narrative voice of the first person, and you can get away with a lot more because you do, especially the first person, but you kind of give yourself up to the narrator. Mm. And you establish a relationship when you're a reader. And you either get on with them or you don't. If you don't, you might throw the book aside after the first page or something. And I think if you can get on with the character in that sense, you'll accept a lot. You know, and I think you do kind of... I think a lot of people got to the stage of thinking, I'm laughing at the fact he's just killed a girl.
His dad says to him, thinking of his dad as a sort of non-monitor of his activities, in the very first chapter says, Dad says, I hope you weren't out killing any of God's creatures. I shrugged at him again. And then the narrator says to us, but not to him, of course I was not killing things. Of course I was out killing things. How the hell am I supposed to get heads of bodies if I don't kill things? You know, but he doesn't say that to the dad, he says that to us. And so we're kind of with him, we're in his world.
Oh, yeah, you're complicit with Frank, I think. So you either accept that, you don't. And I think it's still possible to have I'd hope if I was reading the book, I'd be with Frank in that sense, but still, saying, oh, dear, 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 not another child murderer here, I think you can still retain, a conventional sort of moral attitude to Frank and find Frank's actions absolutely reprehensible and, worthy of punishment, frankly. Well, the kicker, I think, is it too young to get punished at that age if you're killed? I don't know. Do you know, when the Bulger murder happened, I had so many journalists saying, would you write a piece? And, no fucking way, I'm getting Bulger in that. Well, that was, as horrified as anybody else. I wasn't going to start saying, well, I can see that at the point of view. Maybe, oh, fuck off, Jesus Christ. I think you get away with more if you use a first-person narrator. I think an external moral voice would imply a more...
Have you read Lolita? Have you read Lolita? Well, We've got time for one more. If somebody wants to have a lady there, you want to have another nibble? I think we'll give you another nibble.
I like this book ending thing, because this lady asked the very first question.
There's a certain kind of shapeliness
that appeals to my sort of beginning, middle, and end. Obsessive compulsive drive, I think.
I mean, I, it, I just wanted to say that it was interesting that you mentioned complicity. As I say, I have read all of Ian Banks and indeed all of Ian M. Banks, and the only book of all of those that I've actually found genuinely shocking and deeply upsetting was not Complicity, but A Song of Stone, which I have not been able to read more than once. I just can't read that again.
I did think I could. I thought, right, Complicity didn't shock people. Pretty jolly bleak at the end. I disguised the happy ending from The Bridge really well, I thought. I could out bleak that, I thought. So Song of Stone, it was originally called Feu de Joie, obviously literally Fire of Joy, but it's the technical term for when those happy soldier boys, you know, loose rounds into the air because something really nice has happened, like just killed lots of people, whatever. And it was a long narrative poem, what I wrote, I was about very early 20s maybe. And it's basically the same story, there's one or two extra bits. And obviously, in the same way as I think about the horses, it's been comprehensively prosified, as it were. But if it's got any sort of feel of being, you know, poetic or whatever, especially in certain bits, then that's what that comes from. I didn't even try to get the original French title past my publishers, so I knew they'd never wear it. I could hear what all the sales reps in particular, you always listen to the sales reps. Yeah. So I didn't even try. So A Song of Stone is what I came out of that. But yeah, it's incredibly bleak. It's got one really good joke in it, but I wasted it because it's not funny. It's a bit, and it's not very nice, it's a bit sexy as well. It's a bit where the line goes, she's very quiet. Yes, she's thinking aloud. Now, in context, that would have been quite funny. I'd have probably done it for a male character. That's the only joke in the whole book. And I kind of wasted it. It's just not, it's surrounded by such horribleness that even that becomes unfunny. So, bleak is bleak, 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 bleak with a capital B on a bleak day in Bleaksville.
Well, never at the book club anyway has an author recommended one of his own texts so forbiddingly. I've got an itch to go and get it now.
You won't like
I don't like being told not to. I think I might go and read that.
Also, no refunds, okay?
But anyway, it's time. If Ian, I think will you sign some books afterwards?
Happily, yes. Work?
And just to say thanks so much for coming
and
talking to us.
It's fun, thank you.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.